that any child would rather be from a broken home than live in one. Research tells us that quite obviously children do better in a well-adjusted two-parent home than in a single-parent home. However, the same research tells us that children do better in a well-adjusted single-parent home than in a hostile, emotionally barren, or chaotic two-parent home. If children do better when they're exposed to both parents and when there's a healthy relationship among everyone involved, then, post-divorce, your goal further becomes to create that situation regardless of the geography of the living arrangements. Even though you and your ex have terminated your romantic and committed relationship and taken up separate residences, you can still commit to having a mutually supportive relationship as co-parents of your children. If the two of you are willing to prioritize your child's interest, it will be easy to focus on what you need to do to minimize divorce-related trauma. What you and your former spouse must resolve to do is form an alliance, recognizing that you have not ended your relationship, but instead changed it from an intimate, emotional, and romantic day-to-day affiliation to a relationship that's held together by common goals for your children. Joining with your ex and unselfishly putting hurt feelings, the pain of betrayal, and a dysfunctional history aside is a tremendous gift to your children. To be cold, sabotaging, hurtful, or exclusionary with your former spouse is, in some sense, to do the same to your children. If you haven't ever thought about it that way, then let me tell you why you should. Children have a powerful genetic, emotional, and historical bond with both of their parents. And they need a healthy relationship with both of their parents. If you, by pursuing your own agenda of seeking payback for hurt feelings, resentment, and anger, alienate your child from your ex-spouse, you're attacking and hurting your child's ability to become well-adjusted. If your child seems to side with you, you may tell yourself you're winning, but I can assure you, you are not. If you undermine your ex, I promise you that your children will ultimately turn on and resent you for it. It's sweet poison. It may feel good today to know your children are loyal to you, love you more, and would rather be with you than your ex, but in the long run, your children will recognize that what you did was selfish and hurtful to them. That's a fact you can't and won't escape. So even if you don't work to create a healthy relationship between you and your ex and between your ex and your children because it's the right thing to do, do it for selfish reasons. You'll pay a high price with your children if you don't. Is it possible there are circumstances such as mental illness, alcoholism, drug addiction, or other self-destructive lifestyles that preclude a healthy parent from supporting the relationship between their ex and their children? Absolutely. If that's the case, you shouldn't lie about the realities, and you certainly shouldn't subject your child to that kind of influence. But make sure your assessment of your ex is objective and not colored by anger, and make sure you're not using these issues to gain a selfish advantage with your child. If it's less damning to characterize your ex's issues as illness, then do so. Preserve the relationship for their future in the hope that your ex comes around to better behavior. Although it probably sounds illogical, the best way to know you're ready to get a divorce and therefore ready to form a new co-parent relationship is when you can walk out the door with no anger, resentment, bitterness, or unfinished emotional business. You're probably thinking, if it's possible to feel such acceptance about the relationship, why break up? Let me clarify. The time to get a divorce is when you can look at yourself in the mirror and honestly say that you've done everything possible to rehabilitate and save your marriage. If you still harbor powerful and strong ill feelings, you still have work to do. I bring this up not to coax you into a guilt-driven effort to reconcile with your ex, but rather to make it clear that you must get past hurt feelings so you can have a cooperative working relationship with your child's other parent. If you were not in this state of mind when the marriage ended, commit to getting there now. your child shouldn't pick up the tab for his parents' inability to get along. You have a high calling here, and that calling is to nurture and prepare your children for life, despite your ill-fated union. You must put your own emotional agenda to rest. If doing so requires professional help, then get it. Even if you're financially strapped, there are resources in your community and at your church or house of worship that I know will step up and help a parent in need. Whatever it takes to create a healthier working relationship with your child's other parent, then you must do it. You should affirmatively commit to a family and parenting strategy that will help your child flourish in a divorced home. Key components of such a strategy include: 1, commit to learn, adopt, and apply all the principles set forth in Family First. The philosophies, tools, and strategies described here are critical to having a healthy, happy family and raising successful, authentic children, whether or not both parents live in the home. 2, sit down with your ex and make an affirmative plan that sets aside any differences you may have and focuses instead on meeting the needs of your children. If you must agree to disagree about what did or didn't happen in your marriage, put the focus on what needs to happen now to make sure your children don't have to pay the price for your marital misfire. 3, agree with your ex that you absolutely won't disparage one another to your children. Further, forbid your children to speak disrespectfully about the other parent, even though it may be music to your ears. 4, negotiate and agree on how you can best handle such things as handing off the children for visitation, holidays, or events. Although the court probably set parameters for such things in terms of timing, in the interest of your children's peace and security, it's up to you to act maturely and without selfishness. 5, agree on boundaries and behavioral guidelines for raising your children so that there's consistency in their lives regardless of which parent they're with at any given time. This should include such things as bedtime, television and computer access, socializing, and other daily behavioral situations and circumstances. 6, with regard to extended family members, negotiate and agree on the role they'll play and the access they'll be granted while your child is in each other's charge. I strongly believe that extended family plays a very important role in the lives of children, and that particularly the role of both sets of grandparents should be active and free-flowing so long as the grandparents acknowledge and agree to the same standards the divorced couple has agreed on. Your parents disparaging your ex to your children is as unacceptable as you disparaging your ex to your children. 7, communicate actively with your ex and vice versa about all aspects of your child's development. Both parents should know about any and all positive or negative events in your child's developmental journey. If there are problems at school or with friends or even wonderful achievements, both parents should be fully up to speed so consistent responses can be given. If need be, do so in writing or via email, but do it. 8, recognize that children are prone to testing a situation and manipulating boundaries and guidelines, especially if there's a chance to get something they may not ordinarily be able to obtain. It's important that you and your ex compare notes before jumping to conclusions or condemning one another about what may have happened. 9, although it may be emotionally painful, make sure that you and your ex keep the other informed about changes in your life circumstance so that your child is never, ever the primary source of information. If you're dating someone, changing jobs, or contemplating a move, be mature enough to inform your ex so he or she doesn't hear it from the child, who may then have to suffer the reaction. 10, commit to conducting yourself with emotional integrity. If you and your ex have agreed to a plan, stick to it. Say what you mean what you say. Absolutely do not secretly curry favor with your child by giving more or allowing more than the other parent. Doing so is nothing less than passive-aggressive sabotage, and it will ultimately hurt your child. Embracing these do's and don'ts will help considerably to normalize your children's lives. The key is for you and your ex to take the high road and truly make sacrifices for your children. It isn't only self-indulgent, but self-destructive for you to thrust your children in the middle of an emotional crossfire. What's more, they simply don't want to hear it. I've talked to so many children in divorced homes who tell me they are so sick to death of listening to their parents complain and whine about each other that they could just scream. So don't be a tedious, immature bore. You wanted children, and now you have them. The fact that your relationship didn't work out is unfortunate, but it's not their fault. If your former spouse simply won't get in the game and adhere to the guidelines I've set forth, you must do so anyway. The only person you control is you. And let me appeal to your greed by saying that if you do take the high road, in the long run, your children will admire you for it. The day will come when they will look back and say, "My mother or father behaved with such class, dignity, and respect that I can see how much he or she loved me and wanted peace and tranquility in my life. I'm so grateful for that gift. I only wish my other parent had been so selfless." If in addition to divorcing, you've also made the decision to remarry, you have a whole new set of challenges before you in addition to the challenges of traditional divorce families. Whether or not your new spouse will be bringing children into the relationship, the family will have at least one new member. And that will create challenges for you, especially if you're the one being brought into a pre-existing family. Definitely include your children in the wedding ceremony. If they have a special role and you can make it a positive experience, you will be a lot closer to a harmonious home. It's important to recognize from the outset that if one or both of you have children, whether or not you're the custodial parent with whom the children primarily reside, there are strong emotions associated with those relationships. In addition to the strong ties that exist between any biologically connected parent and child, there may be additional emotional energy created by the parent and child's having been in the same divorce foxhole prior to the new marriage. This increased emotion will very likely take the form of protectiveness on the part of the parent. That parent may be thinking that the child has already been hurt, and the parent will be on edge about how the child is treated in the new family setup. For the new spouse, the experience can be one of walking on eggshells, trying not to make a parenting move that is regarded as out of bounds or that creates unfortunate echoes of the past. These are things that you and your new spouse should discuss before your marriage takes place. But of course, it's never too late. I'm going to discuss what I believe are the most important aspects of having a step-parent in a relationship with your children and of being the step-parent that has to form a workable relationship with someone else's children. Quite frankly, much of the challenge here is the same as the challenge that would be facing any couple getting ready to have a child. I would tell any couple that's about to have a baby that they should sit down and discuss and, where necessary, negotiate a plan that includes such topics as the role each parent would play in parenting and facilitating the development of the child, the division of labor concerning the child, such as feeding, bathing, supervising, doctor visits, homework, discipline, and so forth, expectations as to how much space there will be in a relationship for the couple to be a couple, occasionally doing things without the child. What kind of access grandparents and other extended family members would have. Long-term goals and priorities concerning education and other developmental opportunities. Financial planning and priorities. These global topics should certainly be discussed within families that have or are about to be merged, or if a step-parent is about to be added. Whether you're about to embark on this journey or are already well down the road, I recommend working through the above checklist early and often to ensure everyone's compasses are aligned. It's particularly important that I cover here the role of the step-parent and how to make that role as positive as possible. First, let's talk about how the step-parent should relate to the children. If both parents are in the step-parent as well as biological parent role, because both have primary or even partial custody of their children, expectations of each other may differ. In other words, you may trust yourself to discipline his children, but not him to discipline yours. That's okay. What's important is that you each have an understanding and hopefully a negotiated agreement about how the step-parent role will be defined. Once you understand what each other's expectations are, you have a place to start shaping what the step-parent role will be. I always think it's important to first identify what you can agree on and thereby narrow your differences. To handle this situation with the utmost efficiency, both the biological and the step-parent should begin with an open and candid discussion about the fears and expectations regarding the relationship with the children. Each should know what the other expects concerning the step-parent's involvement in guiding, supervising, and disciplining the children. If both parents are in the step-parent as well as biological parent role, because both have primary or even partial custody of their children, expectations of each other may differ. In other words, you may trust yourself to discipline his children, but not him to discipline yours. That's okay. What's important is that you each have an understanding and hopefully a negotiated agreement about how the step-parent role will be defined. Once you understand what each other's expectations are, you have a place to start shaping what the step-parent role will be. I always think it's important to first identify what you can agree on and thereby narrow your differences. How you ultimately define the step-parent role will, of course, be up to you. The following are my recommendations based on what I've seen work, what I've seen fail, and how I think it's best to set up and define the step-parent role. Number one, it's my strong belief that unless you, as the step-parent, are added to the family when the children are very young, it will most likely be very difficult for you to discipline your spouse's children. Every situation is different, but in most situations, disciplining your non-biological children is fraught with danger, since it's likely to create resentment on the part of your spouse. Again, this isn't always the case, and if that's not the circumstance in your family, that's great, because it can give the biological parent an additional resource for handling discipline issues. While I don't believe it's very likely a workable situation for a step-parent to be a direct disciplinarian, it's extremely important that the step-parent be an active supporter of the biological parent's disciplinary efforts. The step-parent can help with enforcement and with monitoring for compliance, even if it's not their role to initiate the discipline. Both biological and step-parents should discuss the rules of the house and negotiate an agreement for what standards the children will be held to. This element of family life should be subject to the same negotiation and joint ownership as any other family situation. Number two, the step-parent, although not actively initiating direct discipline, should certainly work to maintain the normal boundaries that exist between an adult and a child. Although it may be the biological parent who delivers the initial consequences for misbehavior, it's important that the step-parent be active in support of that decision, and care should be taken that proper respect and acknowledgement of the step-parent be given. In other words, a stepfather is not simply mother's husband. He is, in fact, an adult and an authority figure in the home. Number three, in relating to all the children, the step-parent should seek to define his or her relationship as that of an ally and supporter. Whether the step-parent is the same or opposite-sex parent, their presence can play an important balancing role in terms of modeling and information giving about life from the male or female point of view. The role of ally and supporter is in no way to be construed as an attempt to replace the biological parent. Number four, it's important that the step-parent not have unrealistic expectations about their level of closeness or intimacy with their stepchildren. Relationships are built, and it takes time and shared experiences to create a meaningful one. The step-parent should also be aware that the child may be experiencing a fair amount of emotional confusion and may in fact feel guilty, and that they're betraying their biological mother or father by having a close and caring relationship with their stepmother or father. Great care and patience should be taken to allow the child an opportunity to work through these feelings. Number five, the stepmother or father should actively support the child's relationship with the biological mother or father no longer in the home. If you are in the role of stepfather, you should make it a priority to nurture a relationship between you and the biological father and to find every possible way you can to support a relationship between him and his children. By taking the high road of facilitation, you'll find it easier to overcome feelings of resentment both on the part of the biological father and the children he no longer has daily access to. This may require some real internal commitment on your part, because supporting your stepchildren's relationship with their biological but absent parent may seem tantamount to also supporting that parent's relationship with your spouse. Don't let jealousy or envy of the bond they share with their children or the working relationship in history with your current mate cause you to be less than supportive of that relationship. Number six, if you're the step-parent in a truly blended family where both you and your spouse have children being merged into a yours, mine, and ours scenario, you must take great care to not be perceived as playing favorites through a double standard in which your children enjoy a better standard of treatment than your stepchildren. The truth is, however unpopular or politically incorrect it may be to say, you'll very likely have decidedly stronger positive emotional feelings for your biological children than for your stepchildren, at least in the beginning. You'll need to cloak this difference in emotional intensity. As time goes on and you share life experiences with your stepchildren, there will be a leveling of emotions towards all the children. In the meantime, you should be hypersensitive to the need to deal with each in a like fashion. It can be very helpful in the early going to actually quantify and balance the time, activities, and money spent on biological and non-biological children. Number seven, if you as the biological parent are having frustrations with the step-parent and what they're doing in relation to your children, I encourage you at a very early point to stop complaining and start specifically asking for what you want and need. If, for example, you feel they're spending more time playing games with their children, ask them specifically, for example, to play 3 board games per week with your child. If he or she took his or her biological children to a fun fast food restaurant, perhaps innocently, because he just happened to be passing by one after picking his kids up from the Y, he may not consciously realize that your biological child was left out. Specifically ask for what you specifically want. In summary, let me say it's true that it's difficult to see things through someone else's eyes if you haven't walked in their shoes. Whether you're the step-parent or it's your spouse who's in that role, talk frequently about how it's going and what the experience is from the other's point of view. If both of you have good intentions and a loving heart, this can be worked out. A biological parent can be given what he needs to protect his children. A step-parent can be given the time she requires to travel the relation-building learning curve. The key is to remember that the children are passengers on this train. They didn't get an opportunity to choose whether they wanted a new family member, so great care and patience should be taken to help them accommodate to the situation. As you go forward through Family First, Remember that all the philosophies, evaluations, and tools apply to your situation as a single or blended family parent. You have the same challenges before you that every other parent must deal with to create a phenomenal family. I've addressed some of the specific challenges you face by being in this particular situation. I do not presume to suggest that I have covered the whole gamut of challenges you are facing or will face. Hopefully, you'll find and embrace my additional recommendations as you move forward through the rest of this audiobook.
Chapter 3, The 5 Factors for a Phenomenal Family.
Starting right now, you can begin to make choices and take day-to-day actions that will create nothing short of a phenomenal family. Whether your family functions well and you want to make it better, or it's a dysfunctional mess, it didn't get that way by accident or by some outsider's doing. Whatever its state, you and your family members collectively own it. Whatever is happening, good or bad, it's happening on your watch. You, as the parent and leader of the family, have particular ownership. My dad used to say the world is made up of the haves and the have-nots, and that it was up to me to choose by my thoughts and actions which I wanted to be, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, financially, and in every other way. I think he was right. If you want different, you have to choose different. Having a phenomenal family doesn't require that you had a great upbringing with positive role models, and nor does it require that your kids say, "Wow, great ideas, Mom, I'm pumped, let's do it." You can choose to have a phenomenal family if you just resolve to do it and know where to put your focus. That's where the 5 factors for a phenomenal family come in. These factors aren't inherited, and they're not particularly difficult to implement. Creating these factors in your family begins with you, which is why I addressed your personal truth in Chapter 1. You must start by believing in yourself and your family's right to be phenomenal. When I say phenomenal family, I'm talking about a family where each member is a star in their own right. Each gets to use their gifts, skills, and talents and feel good about who they are and how they fit in. They get to live with hope, passion, and energy. Theirs is an experience of being loved, nurtured, valued, and given everything they need to go out into the world as capable, healthy, and self-confident individuals. A phenomenal family is a healthy family, too, in which each person's well-being is advanced and protected for the benefit of the entire family. At the same time, there is an interconnectedness among members that bonds the family. Much like mountain climbers who rope themselves together when climbing a mountain so that if someone should slip or need support, he's held up by the others until he regains his footing. Understand, too, that this interconnectedness has a glue, a feeling of all of us are in this together. We all get painted with each other's brush when we are in a family. This chapter is about saying, "My family can enjoy a closer, more connected life together, sharing strength, with each person feeling affirmed and uplifted in life-changing ways. Mine can be a family that attains new levels of caring, encouragement, and acceptance. My family will have opportunities to reach for the best and have the best. And most important, we leave no one behind." Being phenomenal is no fantasy. This can be done. The 5 factors for a phenomenal family that you are about to learn here will give you the power to take your family to a higher level of functioning if you are willing to let them become the new foundation for your family life. It's these factors that will help you lead your family in the direction of greater happiness, fulfillment, and love. You must decide that your family is worthy of everything you want for them. You must decide that peace, joy, and abundance in a family are not just for the people next door or down the street. It's for your family. Part of the solution is exactly this: having a new mindset, a new philosophy and personal truth, as well as a plan of action. In taking up these challenges, you're going to be operating from a position of strength rather than weakness, because you'll be wielding valuable knowledge and clarity instead of confusion. Knowledge is power, And knowing these five factors and having a very specific action plan for their implementation will enable you to step up and claim good things for your family. It's time for you to become a have instead of a have-not. Let today mark for you and your family a fresh start and a new commitment. Your family doesn't have to live with the same old patterns and mindsets. You have the ability and the power to choose how your family lives, and the more you exercise your power to choose, the more phenomenal your family will be. So start now and go into this with the attitude that you're going to reparent your family. Resolve to get your mind right and your behavior on track. Here are the five factors with action-oriented recommendations for change. Factor number one, create a nurturing and accepting family system. The number one need in all people is the need for acceptance, the need to experience a sense of belonging to something and someone. The need for acceptance is more powerful in your family than anywhere else. Let me ask you, have you ever stopped to consider why some kids pledge such undying loyalty to a team, a clique, a peer group, or even the wrong crowd? It's because those groups, good or bad, meet their need for emotional security, expression, and belongingness. If that need is not met by your family, trust me, your kids will go elsewhere to seek it in order to find approval and acceptance. There's a lot at stake here because you want those powerful affiliations to be devoted to your family. But when you meet these needs in your own family, your children are less likely to turn inappropriately to outside groups. If your children experience in your family the spirit of acceptance, then they will find you approachable and they will turn to you because they know that their family is a loving place to fall. Since this factor is such a core requirement for building a phenomenal family, here is what I would wish for you to be thinking, saying, and folding into your personal truth now, during, and after you've heard factor number one. I want and claim the right for my children to feel appreciated and valued by me and everyone in our family. I do not want them to ever feel alone or doubt their place in a loving and committed family. I want my kids to know and feel that they are loved for who they are, that I am proud of them, and that I will always be there for them. I may not endorse everything they do, but I will never reject them. If any member of my family feels like their contributions are not being recognized or acknowledged by others in the family, that's not okay, not now, not ever. I believe that children live what they learn, and I want to teach them by example that relationships in our family are sacred to be honored and to be cherished. I know that family life has its ups and downs, its arguments, problems, conflicts, and differences of opinion. There has never been a family that was free of rough spots, but I want our family relationships to be so strong that they transcend the inevitable daily strife of family living. I want everyone in my family to be true to themselves, loving themselves, feeling fulfilled, and living with peace, joy, and excitement about each new day. Right now, maybe you're thinking that these objectives are out of your reach, that they represent some kind of pipe dream, fantasy, beaver cleaver, goody two-shoes family where everyone walks around with a plastic smile. If that type of family ever existed, it certainly doesn't now. I am not telling you to pretend that there are not problems or that they will go away. There are good times and bad in every family, so please don't be intimidated by the lofty sound of the qualities of an accepting, nurturing family. Don't be deceived into thinking they are restricted from you. Let me assure you that they are accessible to you if you desire them for your family. Anyone can create an accepting and nurturing environment. That is an important truth for you to claim and live. Take a quiet moment and reflect on the love in your heart for each member of your family. You need to look no further for your fuel, your strength, and your power. Now, let's talk about how you can bring this spirit of acceptance into affirmative, interactive action in your family. The following is a specific to-do list. Put your family on project status. For you to create a nurturing, accepting family, you must, starting right now, put your family on what I call project status. This means that you must consciously decide to actively, purposefully work on improving your family situation each and every day. I don't mean that you need to, want to, or intend to work on it. I mean you do it every single day, starting right now in very specific real-life actions. Putting your family on project status may require significant sacrifices. In fact, as radical as it may seem, you may need to do such things as reschedule or forego work or business activities in order to make time to spend with your children. Life is a series of choices, and money cannot win every time. Change your normal routine so that you can spend more time with your children. This may include reading to your children at bedtime, doing hobbies together, or having a family night each week. Make an appointment with your family and keep it. Set aside an hour a day for the family every day. Sometimes this is the hardest requirement because it means you have to prioritize your activities. I realize that there are a lot of other important things to do, but this is something you do not put off. Do it today. Help your children set and achieve goals. A family on project status is a goal-oriented family. Your kids need direction in their lives. When my son Jay was researching his book, Life Strategies for Teens, he interviewed a lot of kids on whether they use drugs and alcohol or not. The kids who did drugs and drank alcohol said they did it because they didn't have any reason not to. They were doing it to have fun. On the other hand, the kids who chose not to use these substances had a completely different answer. They told Jay, "We don't do drugs or alcohol because it doesn't fit our plan." These teens were saving money for a car, working towards tryouts for sports teams, debate squads, or concentrating on getting scholarships to college. In other words, they had goals, and doing drugs was an impediment to those goals. It wouldn't get them what they wanted. It wasn't just a higher morality. They selfishly refused drugs and alcohol. They asked themselves the age-old question, "What's in it for me?" As a parent, you can be an influential person in helping your kids set goals, either by setting an example yourself or actually giving them milestones to work for. As they say, idle hands are the devil's workshop. Passionately adopt a mindset that you will be committed for the long haul. A tried and true formula fits the bill here. Be, do, have. Be committed, do what it takes, and you will have what you want. Don't decide to work on your family life for just a week or a month or some preset period of time. You must parent your children until. Commit at a project status level to bring out the authenticity of every family member. Each child in your family came into this world with a core set of unique skills, abilities, interests, and talents, all of which make up their genuine identity, their authentic self. It is all of their strengths and gifts that are uniquely theirs and need expression. This self is not who you want them to be. It is who they are uniquely skilled, gifted, and predisposed to be. This journey can be amazing and exciting as you discover or rediscover your very own child. Authentic is a word we don't use much in our day-to-day conversation, so let me define it, particularly as I think it applies to children. Authentic children have a sense of hope, a feeling that today is as fun and exciting as yesterday, and that tomorrow will be as fun and exciting as today. These children have a passion and excitement about what's happening in their lives and what's going to happen next. They feel good about themselves. They have found interest or qualities that just light them up. They're self-assured and self-accepting. Their young lives are filled with vivid colors like a box of crayons, and they go about each day doing or discovering what they absolutely, unequivocally, passionately love. An authentic child is a joyful child, and because they have such a positive spirit, they are seldom oppositional. They have a self-respect as well as respect for others. They're responsible and they're accountable in age-appropriate ways. The problem is that your children's authentic self may have started out clean, solid, and brand new, like the last pair of new sneakers you bought them. Remember, they were unmarked and well-constructed, not a scuff on them. If you left those sneakers in the shoebox sitting on the shelf in the closet, they would stay in pristine condition. But life is not about sitting on the sidelines. Once your kids wear those sneakers out into the world, they're subjected to the forces, dirt, and demands of hard play. They start to show scuffs, the wear and tear that comes from being out in the world. Like those sneakers, your child's authentic self gets scuffed up because the world, including you, begins to write on the slate of who they are. And these life experiences, these writings, begin changing who they are. Maybe it is the tension and fighting in your household, your divorce, being picked on at school, or negative modeling from you or other adult authority figures that begins to obscure that bright light, that joyous and authentic spirit. Life can be hard, and that's why it's so important that the family environment be your child's oasis. It's through all of these life experiences that kids start getting programmed to believe what they're expected to be and do, rather than what they are meant to do. But there is an authentic child in there. It shined briefly before the pains of growing up and experiencing life marked it up. There's an authentic self within each of your children, and within you as well. And it's your job to create a family environment that will bring it out. The following suggestions will help you get started on ways to discover and bring to the surface the authenticity and hidden talents and interest of each of your children. This may mean that you have to plow some new ground. Open the door to different experiences for your children. Music, art, dramatics, literature, science, leadership, travel, sports, and so forth. With your encouragement, expose your children to different experiences, letting them color outside the lines to see what catches hold. Allow them to pursue activities so that they might discover an interest that they might not even know they have, whether you enjoy those activities or not. Now, this means that you will have to be open-minded and kiss a lot of frogs along the way. Take careful note of the activities and experiences your children naturally gravitate toward. Again, do not choose just things that you like or think they will like. Take a risk. Have some fun. Begin to recognize and observe in your children particular talents or a streak of intelligence and inspire them to develop it. If your child likes to plunk the keys on the piano, take her to a recital or suggest piano lessons. Verbally gifted children usually speak or read at a young age. You can nurture this gift by giving them books, finding opportunities for writing, giving them a computer for writing. If you see that your child is good in math or enjoys puzzles, he may be mathematically gifted or skilled in science. Aptitudes that can be encouraged by taking them to science fairs or computer exhibitions, providing them with a computer, or doing science experiments together. Visually oriented children like to draw or build things. You can encourage this gift with art supplies, construction kits, or visits to art museums. Respect and encourage your children's uniqueness. Every person's particular likes, dislikes, interests, and talents, no matter how different from one another they may be, are respected and room is made for those idiosyncrasies so long as that uniqueness is not destructive to self or others. In fact, everyone is encouraged to be uniquely and authentically who they are. Catch your children doing something right. Far too often, kids hear about what they've done wrong. Constant fault-finding can and will shoot down a child's sense of self-worth and initiative. If you're criticizing, you're not praising. You must start praising your children for positive behavior. Tell your children things like, "You're doing a great job of getting your homework done. I'm pleased to see that you did such a fine job of cleaning your room. I appreciate you sharing your toys with your little brother. Thank you for helping your mother with the dishes. Acknowledgments like these go a long way toward building character and self-esteem in your children. Look for the best intentions in your children. Too often we think that our children misbehave willfully and on purpose. Instead of being quick to blame, choose the high road and assume your child has positive intentions. If your child has drawn a mural on the wall with his crayons, for example, maybe he is just trying to provide stimulation for himself and lacks judgment. He is not necessarily being bad or naughty. And if you label his behavior as such, your child will take it to heart and often come to believe it himself. Then you have real problems. In addition to looking for the best intentions, redirect your child's energy to more appropriate behavior, drawing on an easel rather than your walls, for example. Never, ever overprogram or overschedule your child's time with too many activities. This has the potential of backfiring in a big way by making your child dislike the activity and ultimately give it up. By creating a family environment that gives your children room to explore their unique gifts, talents, and interests at their own pace and with your encouragement and support, you have constructed a nurturing atmosphere where they begin to live and radiate an authentically directed childhood. Create a sense of security and peace in your home. Your children look to you and your spouse as a solid and safe base of operations. And your home should be a place where, whenever your children walk through that door and pull it closed behind them, they don't have to watch their backs or question the loyalties of those within the family. They need to know that they don't have to have their antenna out. Yet when they're subjected to a conflict-ridden home with behaviors such as open hostility, fighting, and other gust of fury between the two people they rely on for their personal security and safety, their base is shaken to the core. They begin to experience insecurity and have fears about the disintegration of the family unit. Where your relationship standards are concerned, commit to yourself that you and your partner will not yell and scream at each other in front of your children. Children also tend to blame themselves for the ugly arguments, the kind that devolve into personal attacks, however illogical that blame might appear to an outsider looking in. They tend to tell themselves, somehow this must be my fault. Kids also think that it's their job to fix things. Can you imagine how terrible it is for them to hold themselves responsible for something over which they have absolutely no control? Moreover, your children are typically not around for the peacemaking. Sadly, they get exposed to all the trials and tribulations without the benefit of participating in the making up. It shakes them to the core, eroding their self-esteem and confidence in their own social situation. In particularly volatile homes, children are afraid even to bring their friends home for fear they'll be embarrassed by the open and uncontrolled hostilities. If you argue and have disagreements, do it with dignity and respect for your partner's sense of self and be mindful of the quarrel's impact on others. It's not necessarily toxic to argue or disagree in front of your children as long as you do it without yelling, screaming, and name-calling. Let's face it, family members do disagree. Honest disagreements can actually provide a good lesson in that family members can learn that people who love each other can disagree and express their own views without fear of losing each other and their base of operations. Children who never see an appropriate argument might become naive and vulnerable to the realities of relationships later in life. It's only when the arguments deteriorate into yelling and screaming and character assassination that the security of individuals and the strength of the family is threatened. It's then that children become insecure. So how can you ensure that your family becomes and remains a secure, stable base for your children and not a war zone? To help you answer that question, here are some actions that you will want to take now. Number one, take it private and keep it private. Fighting unfairly with yelling and character assassination in front of your children is nothing short of child abuse. It can and will scar them emotionally, all because you don't have the self-control to contain yourself until you can talk privately. If you simply can't control your temper and you allow your disagreements to deteriorate into personal attacks rather than problem-solving sessions, at least confront your spouse behind closed doors and don't make your innocent child pick up the tab. Number two, stop being a right fighter, arguing over who is right and who is wrong. Your kids don't care who is right. They just want you to stop fighting. Number three, don't say you can't control your temper. That's not true. It's that you don't control your temper. Have you had fights at your boss's house, at church, at restaurants, with friends? You don't do it when you can't. The only person you control is you. Choose to control your impulses. Find a different outlet for your frustration. Don't take it out on your children. Children learn what they live. Stop and think about what you're teaching them when you demonstrate poor impulse control yourself. Number four, if you do have an honest disagreement, let your children see the resolution. Share a moment of peace to reaffirm your bond once a resolution or decision has been reached. This might be, for example, a silent 60-second hug, or just looking into each other's eyes for a minute. Number five, eliminate patterns of verbal abuse. You are a pivotal person in your child's life. When you yell, criticize, or embarrass your child, you're leaving a permanent mark on him or her. When you fail to point out what makes you proud, why a child is special, or that you love him, you also write on the slate of that child. In the printout material that accompanies this audiobook, you'll find the heading, How to Eliminate Verbal Abuse. This is a chart of steps you can take to condition yourself to stop verbal abuse. The same steps can be used if you are emotionally or physically abusive. Number six, actively support each other every day. Make it a family policy to give one another at least one supportive remark a day. More is better, but a minimum of one per day. This can be as easy as saying, I'm thinking of you when you take that test today, or I know that life seems strange sometimes, but I want you to know that we are in it together. These statements can become the most powerful in a child's life sometimes, and we may never know it. In addition, ask your family members how they're doing, and don't take fine as a final answer. Look them in the eyes, really ask, and be prepared to listen in order to generate an honest reply. Take an interest in the root of your children's lives. Number seven, deal forthrightly with destructive behavior. Acceptance of family members does not mean acceptance of every attitude or behavior. It does mean valuing the human being and looking for what is worthy, vulnerable, and good. If there's a situation where someone is behaving destructively or outrageously, being disrespectful, misbehaving, drinking, or using drugs, you can deal with him or her in a way that clearly communicates that the behavior is unacceptable, yet in a way that ultimately promotes his or her self-esteem. You can say, for instance, I can't and won't tolerate or endorse your behavior because I know you are a better person than this. I'm not judging you because I know you have good qualities, traits, and characteristics. I know you can respond in a healthier, more positive way. And I won't let you be less than who you are. I'm going to require you to be that better person. Respect and overtly acknowledge the roles and contributions of each family member. In a healthy, interconnected family, everybody has a role and everybody has a purpose. In fact, everyone should feel and know that they have a contribution to make to that family, that it would matter terribly if they weren't there. As I mentioned earlier, during my junior high and high school years, I was very much into athletics. Frequently, my family would come to my games and watch me play football under the bright lights of our school stadium, or play basketball in an emotionally charged field house, or wrestle in a jam-packed gymnasium. For a family that was poor, with no money for entertainment and no prospects of any, going to my athletic events was a real bright spot. If I scored a touchdown or made a big play, there was great family pride. People would come up to my father, slap him on the back, and say, "Great game, Joe," just as if he had played the game himself. I was the family entertainment and a source of pride. As withdrawn as I was, that was one of my roles. It was currency for me and served a needed purpose for the family. I felt good about it because what I did mattered. Some families have a court jester, the designated family cut-up. Usually, the mother in a family is the glue, the adhesive that binds that family together. Mothers also typically fulfill the role of nurturer, particularly in making sure everyone is nourished, forcing food on everyone if necessary. Although roles are flexible and subject to change, there is no blurring of roles between parents and children in a healthy family. There is a hierarchy within the family, a pecking order that is very clear. Establishing clear roles in your